From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Whitmer says schools should prepare for in-person instruction this fall.
Nothing's more important than the safety of our kids and school staff. And we know that nothing can replace the value of face-to-face instruction.
Also, Michigan Radio's newest podcast, Kids These Days, looks at what it's like being a teenager right now.
I'm mixed. My mom is black, white, and Arab, and my dad's white. We've been talking about race, my race, since forever.
Plus, one musician and producer talks about a song simmered in the same elements that have brought so many Michiganders to protest in the streets.
I believe that the marching and the protesting is easy to do when you're angry. It's easy to do when you've been cooped up on quarantine for the last 3 months. And I hope that the energy maintains. I hope that we can keep it going.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we dig into the latest updates from Governor Whitmer's office on the spread of COVID-19 in Michigan. But first, what kind of conversations are you and your family having about race? Today, Michigan Radio launches its latest podcast called Kids These Days. The first of 9 episodes talks about life as a teenager, tackling some of these tough questions. We'd like to share their thoughts and work with you here on Stateside. So let's listen today to episode 1 of Kids These Days.
Hi, I'm Maisie Perry. This is Kids These Days, a podcast all about teens, what we're thinking about, laughing about, and stressing about. The show is a collaboration between Michigan Radio and Community High School in Ann Arbor. And we just want to say right up front here, we know our experiences do not reflect all of America. We are a group of mostly white teenagers from a mostly white high school in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And we want to make it clear we are aware of our privilege. We are continuing to educate ourselves on what more we can do during this time. This podcast is just one small window into teen life. But wherever you are and wherever you're from, we hope this podcast will make you feel less alone. We've been thinking a lot about the state of the country, well, really the state of the world, in the past few weeks. And we think it makes sense to start with this poem by one of our classmates, Leah Dewey.
I hesitate, yet the first word that comes to mind is despair. Merriam-Webster defines it as the utter loss of hope. Some say I'm too pessimistic. They say I'm a part of the problem. But how can I be hopeful? What is left to give me hope? The healthcare system is failing. The law enforcement system is failing. The judicial system is failing. Black people can't get access to good healthcare. Black people are killed by those who are supposed to protect us. Black people make up 13% of the U.S. population and 38% of the U.S. prison population. What hope is there in news headlines, life sentences, public vigils? What hope is there in bodies riddled with bullets, knees pinned down on necks, black skin turned purple by batons? What hope is there in stop shooting, I don't have a gun? What hope is there in I can't breathe? What hope is there for America, the free? For George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner. For every black human stripped of humanity, for every black life that is no longer living, for every black body that becomes just another dead body. I hope that as unrest fills the streets, your souls can rest in peace. I wrote that after police killed George Floyd in Minneapolis. I wrote it after they killed George Floyd and so many other black people in this country, as they have been doing for hundreds of years. Teens have been on the streets protesting, and for a lot of us, especially for black teens, this is a resounding cry fighting for our right to live and to live in peace. We're coming to you from Ann Arbor, a city that is steeped in whiteness. And I know the stuff I talk about with my family in my home is going to be different from what most of my classmates talk about in their homes. I'm mixed. My mom is black, white, and Arab, and my dad's white. We've been talking about race, my race, since forever. I remember in middle school when my mom sat me down to talk. It was after Michael Brown was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. I have family in Missouri, and they knew Michael Brown.
Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, I remember.
This is my mom, Kelly Stuppel.
I remember that I just wanted you to be aware of your surroundings at all times when you were out and about, and that to know that law enforcement sees Black teenagers differently than they see white teenagers, especially when they're in groups. And although I feel like, you know, maybe you could pass for white under certain circumstances, a lot of your friends can't. And if you were out together, that you might be a target.
I remember when you talked to me in middle school and you warned me about police stopping me. I didn't really take it seriously because I didn't think these things could happen to me. I didn't think they were always news headlines for someone else.
Yeah, and I guess I was hoping that because, you know, we're connected to Michael Brown through that family connection, that maybe somehow that would bring it home for you. Also, the fact that he was a teenager, I was hoping that would make it maybe more real for you. But perhaps you just weren't ready to take it in. I think you know now, though, that it's pretty serious and that it could happen to you and it could happen to me.
We've been having these talks my entire life about how to be a person of color in America. In sixth grade, it was about the police. In eighth grade, it was about how to react when someone stereotypes you. In 10th grade, it was about coping with ignorant relatives. In 11th grade, it was about the N-word. And the other day, it was about my cousin.
My nephew, your cousin, was killed on April 30th of this year in a police-involved incident. And although the police have not been particularly forthcoming, and it was in the northern part of St. Louis County, which is where Michael Brown was also killed, I feel hopeful that maybe because this happened now, that there will be more accountability in our own families' quest to find out what happened and how my nephew really died.
I'm Black, and in America, that matters. I don't have the luxury of not talking about my race. To not talk about it could be fatal. 70% of Ann Arbor is white, so I know the talks in most of these houses here don't sound like mine. But still, I wanted to know, what do they sound like? A couple of teens in my class agreed to tape a conversation with their own moms. I think it's helpful in this moment to listen to what some of these conversations are like right now, and to hear how they changed over time, to give us a window into what they are and are not talking about. First up is Lacey Cooper, a junior at my high school. She sat down with her mom, Jeannie. Let's listen.
So how did your parents talk to you about race? And what did those conversations look like?
I would say it was almost entirely absent from my upbringing, any conversation about race.
So as a person growing up in that household, how did that affect you in the way that you looked at race?
I think I was slow to develop any sort of sense about other. Partially, as a kid, you're kind of self-absorbed anyway. When I got to campus, I went to Michigan State University, and when I got to campus, there were huge signs about diversity and people gathering based on race. My first reaction was actually I was a little offended. I was a little bit put out, like, what? Why do they have this? I just had no context.
What was that experience like for you as you kind of were experiencing these concepts and hearing about these experiences for the very first time?
I think I initially felt really defensive. You know, what do you mean? I'm not racist. I never did any of those things. If, you know, someone was sharing experience, it wasn't until I think I had some really good classes on history, which maybe a little embarrassed to say really didn't come until college, that I began to kind of understand differently. And then also, you know, meeting people. I grew up in a very white town. So obviously exposure and beginning to listen and learn began my sort of slow progress to understand things completely differently.
When was the first time we talked about my race and the concept of race was introduced to my siblings?
I don't specifically remember using the word race, but we talked very early on with you about differences between people, but we talked more about diversity. We think we phrased it more that way.
Why have or haven't we talked about race, and could we have talked about it more?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've mostly talked about race specifically in regards to events that have happened. And I think maybe bad things that have happened to people based on their race, which maybe makes me wish that we were talking about race, you know, in other ways too. Maybe we do, but
that's true. I feel like our family doesn't shy away from talking about issues that are often uncomfortable to talk about. Is there anything that you would do differently looking back?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe talking about race more specifically, I guess maybe not different, but more. Does that make sense? Sometimes I worry about that exposure, but then I feel like the risk is on the other side, is not talking about it, not noticing it, not knowing about it, not being exposed to it. And so I guess that's a risk that, you know, I feel is worth taking, even though maybe sometimes my very young children hear things that I wish they didn't have to.
So maybe this conversation sounds familiar to some of the talks you've had with your family. And maybe it really doesn't. These conversations can be different depending on who's having them and what experiences they bring to the table. Coming up after the break, a mother and daughter talk about racism, colorism, and privilege, and their family.
You're tuned in to Stateside. More in a minute, so stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're spending the first part of our show today previewing Michigan Radio's newest podcast, Kids These Days, which you can download or stream today. It's just launched. Let's continue listening to the teens from Community High School in Ann Arbor.
Hey, it's Leah. Like I said before the break, there's no one way to have these talks, and it's pretty revealing to hear what gets included and what doesn't. Ty Torek is 17, and she thinks about race every day. She asked her grandma about growing up in the segregated South and how her great-great-grandfather was enslaved. But Ty has a light complexion, so the conversations she has about race look different from the conversations I've had at home. She sat down to talk about it with her mom, Stephanie Patterson.
I don't think there was ever like a time when anybody sat me down and was like, you're Black and you're white. And like, I think that's so weird because I don't know how it came, like how that knowledge, how I acquired that knowledge.
I don't really remember having actually, you know, the precise day or time, like saying you are African American, you know, but over time, you know, once you guys start getting more out into the world and school and things like that, and then these things come up or these questions come up or you start, you know, that's when kids start noticing differences, right? And so,
and it's kind of like it feels like being mixed, it feels like you're never really enough, in the sense that like I never feel Black enough to relate to everything that's going on right now, like the wake of George Floyd's death. Like I will never experience police brutality in the same way that like my darker skin counterparts will.
Yeah.
And I will never truly be white enough or feel white enough to experience my life day to day without like small little like nuances, I guess. Like one time somebody came up to me and like wiped my eyebrow and was like, you're not really black, are you? Yeah. I was like, are you trying to wipe away the blackness off my skin? Yeah.
Well, that was first thing. I mean, no one has permission to touch anybody.
Yeah.
Then, you know, I mean, but yeah, I mean, I would get the whole thing with the tan. Oh, I'm tanner than you. I must be, you know, that kind of stuff. And then like how dark you get when you're in the sun has nothing to do with my experience or anybody else's experience as a black person day to day, you know? So it's tiresome and burdensome to always have to, you know, explain myself. I'm like, well, why don't you read this or read history or whatever? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, you know.
Do you think that we talk about race like enough?
I've been thinking a lot about like, well, you know, what kind of job have I done for you? You know, it's like, I always wonder like, well, did we equip you well enough or, you know, or did we help you, you know, in your own kind of sense of self?
I mean, I feel like I'll always be insecure about like my identity just because like, I mean, like, no matter how many books I read, no matter how many, like, diverse friends I had, I always felt, like, inherently, like, lesser than just because, like, I either didn't look like my white friends, I didn't look like my mixed friends, or I didn't look like my black friends. I have had to go out of my way to learn about race, and I don't think that's necessarily your fault. I think that's, like, school curriculum. And so I think that if I didn't have that initial curiosity or grow up in a space where like we've all been willing to talk about our experiences, that I wouldn't like be able to learn as much as I have. But it just kind of sucks that you have to go out of your way to learn about things.
Yeah.
But I think like I think about race every day, so it's like it's hard not to.
I mean, it's really hard not to. As a black person in America, it's something you have to think about. For a lot of us, these conversations aren't new, but something feels like it's shifting, especially for my non-black friends. People are talking about it differently and on a national scale. And even though these talks, these conversations about systemic racism aren't new, the air feels different. I've been going to protests in Ann Arbor, and the other day I went to a youth-led protest. There were maybe 60 people there, and the crowd was quite multiracial. I was curious about, you know, why now? Why are young people coming out now to protest? Is the shift that I'm sensing real? So I asked a bunch of the people attending about why they were there.
Well, I think we're the future, so it means a lot for us to use our voice and have a voice and know the things that are going on and be able to inform people of the things that are going on. Like, this is the world we have to live in now, so we have to take over in order to be in a world that we want to live in or that we accept living in.
My parents have been, like, telling me about this and the injustices that black people have gone through every day for my whole life, and so I think that it's really important to, like, show my support and help in any way that I can, really.
I feel like, in general, I feel like human rights is human rights and the color of your skin doesn't define who you are.
You know, we're just trying to showcase that black lives do matter, and we're not saying that all lives don't matter, but until black lives matter, all lives cannot matter, so.
We also ran into Davion Pipkins at the protest. He's 19. He had gone to one of the Detroit protests a few days earlier where he says police beat, handcuffed, and ticketed him. We asked the Detroit Police Department for a comment. A spokesperson says they weren't aware of the incident until we told them about it. She says they plan to launch an investigation.
I can't even look like at the police like at the same or anything like that. Like I never did kind of, but like it's just a different, like you get PTSD. Like even when I see the lights, it's just a different sign of it, you know? So it's just, this is how I'm just dealing with it, I guess.
He's still out here protesting. His mom, she's worried sick about him. Yet Davion says he still feels an obligation to be here.
Something needs to change, and we're going to get a change either way if we got to do this every day, you know? So that's why I keep coming out. Like, everybody's voice needs to be heard. Everybody needs to use their voice.
Hands up! Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
It took Minneapolis police 8 minutes and 46 seconds to kill George Floyd. 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And we've been out here, teenagers, ever since, because this cannot continue. Police brutality, systemic racism, white privilege, none of this is new. This is an old story. A 400-year-old story. But like I said, something about now feels different. Maybe it's social media. It's hard to ignore what's happening when you scroll through video after video of police brutality. Maybe it's because the older generations are failing us and we have to be out here to advocate for ourselves. Maybe it's because Black Americans are dying of COVID-19 at twice the rate of white people. Maybe it's because the pandemic has just made everyone stir crazy. I don't know. But when I look around at the youth out here protesting alongside me, maybe it's that our generation's the generation that's going to smash all this to the ground and help build it back up into something. Something better than this.
Next time on the podcast, millions of teens are stuck at home because of COVID-19.
So far, I have had 4 dance parties, 3 mental breakdowns. It kind of feels like the world is ending.
One teen shares what life is like for her during quarantine. Kids These Days is a collaboration between Community High School in Ann Arbor and Michigan Radio. Kids These Days is made by us, teens, and so is the music and artwork. Reporting for this episode by Lacey Cooper, Ty Torek, Jordan DePadova, Cy Veyu, and Leah Dewey. Jordan DePadova and Max Steiger wrote our theme song. Mia Goldstein created our logo. Additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Rachel Ishikawa is the senior producer. Jennifer Guerra is the executive producer. Bob Scon is our engineer. This episode was edited by Rachel Ishikawa, Jennifer Guerra, and Sarah Hewlett. Special thanks to Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark, Vince Duffy, Jody Westrick, Emma Winowicki, Paulette Parker, Katie Raymond. And special thanks to our teacher, Tracy Anderson. I'm Maisie Perry. See you next time.
Support for Kids These Days comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund, a philanthropic foundation working to improve the health of Michigan residents with a focus on the wellness of children and older adults. More at mihealthfund.org. And from the Children's Foundation, working to improve the health and well-being of children and their families with pediatric research, education, community benefit programs, and other initiatives. On the web at yourchildrensfoundation.org. Like a lot of artists, activists, and just plain folks right now, musician and producer Nadir Omowale has been reflecting and reacting to the protests against police violence happening in Michigan and across America. Nadir is releasing a new single this week. It's a song that he's been working on since 1998, and it's called Run. Nadir Omowale joins us now. Nadir, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
You published a blog post that talked a little bit about the backstory on Run. You've been writing this song since 1998?
Yes. I've actually written it and rewritten it several times since 1998. But the song was originally inspired by an incident that happened in Jasper, Texas, where a man named James Byrd Jr. was chained to the back of a pickup truck and dragged 3 miles by one was a person that he knew and a couple of other people who had known white supremacist ties. And that really struck me at that point. And I kind of got the story wrong at first because I thought that they had chained him by his wrists and that he was upright. And so when I thought of this song, I thought how horrible that is to be running behind a moving vehicle thinking, you know, how far am I going to be able to run before I can't run anymore and fall. But, mm-hmm. But I got the story wrong. They actually chained him by his ankles, which so he didn't even have the ability to run. That's just a horrible, horrible story.
Right. I mean, for those of us who are old enough to remember that incident, I mean, that level of violence was not exactly new to Black Americans. But at the same time, it was so very shocking to so many people. And to just think of that trauma, you know, recurring and continuing over the decades until now, when you finally got the song in a form you were ready to release. I mean, it just speaks a lot to what everyone's been going through.
It does. And that was, it's one thing that I've been going through, you know, as I've been working on the song and, you know, I've put out several albums since then, moved from that. I wrote that when I lived in Nashville and I moved to Michigan, you know, in 1999, and you know, the same things keep happening, and I would just keep refining the song, and so finally the case of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia came up, where he was being chased, and we watch on videotape as he shot with a shotgun after being chased jogging through his own neighborhood. I mean, just ridiculous. And I knew at that point I'd gotten the song closer, and I'd planned on releasing it sometime soon anyway. So that just, you know, made me say, okay, well, I've just got to go ahead and get this thing out right now.
Was the refrain something that has stayed the same in the various iterations of the song?
So when I wrote the song originally, I wrote it on acoustic guitar, and I came up with that chorus, you know, how far can I run? Later, I changed the music, and it's a little bit close. It was a little bit closer to the version that we hear now. And I came up with the can't stop part to speak to something that would be a little bit more universal, that was a little more timeless than just the one incident, because it was far more than, you know, it's far more than the one incident. So I thought about running and the notion of running, and I thought about enslaved people escaping their captivity and running away. So that's when I changed the imagery for the first verse and talk about, you know, I'm on the run, and Lord, they're gaining on me. The hounds are just a breath away.
The hounds are just a breath away. But I'm in this race, can't slow my pace, not one degree. Cause if they catch me, they will throw me back in chains.
Can you tell us about what you wanted for the rhythmic elements of this song?
Yes. So like I said, originally I wrote this on a guitar, but I came up with some African percussion elements, and I wanted it to just kind of, I sped it up a little bit, and I wanted to have that rhythmic plodding, that thing that makes you feel like you're running. And this is a long distance run. It's not a sprint.
That's one of the things that's just marvelous about the song, is the fact that the concept of running comes across both as an urgency, with an urgency, but also that sense of endurance.
One other thing I would add, I had worked with the song for a long time with just the percussion, and just a few months ago, I asked my friend Simone White, who's a drummer that I work with in Australia quite a bit, and so he added the live drum elements, which just make it come alive and make it feel more even more urgent, and make it feel almost like somebody's chasing you and the stumbling, and he just did a really fantastic job of getting that point across as well, and adding to the feeling that you're running.
You wrote this song in part, or maybe I should say, you produced this in such a way that it could be useful to DJs. There are four tracks that can be used together or on their own. How come you wanted to package it that way?
Because it's danceable, and because I wanted to be able to get it to as many different people as possible. Also with DJs, they like to have an instrumental version, because a lot of DJs will a lot of my friends who are DJs from Detroit and all over the world, they'll travel to different countries with different languages, and they play a lot of instrumentals. And then also they like to have an acapella. They could take that acapella and they could put it on another music bed. And then I thought with this track, with the way the percussion works and with Simone's tremendous playing, adding a drumapella, was something that I thought would be really cool, because a lot of that's not something that's done on every dance music song, but it's one of those things where the drums just give that drive and that rhythm. And so that's just creating another opportunity for DJs to use the track. And so I learned from my mentor, Mad Mike Banks at Underground Resistance, that you want to give DJs a toolkit. And if your track is one that they can use like they would use a hammer or a favorite screwdriver, then you're going to get played more often.
It's got to be said, too, there's nothing quite like just drums and vocals to test a song to see if it really holds up. This one does.
Oh, thank you.
We'll continue our conversation with artist and producer Nadir Omowale in just a minute. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking with artist and producer Nadir Omowale today. Before the break, we were discussing his new song, Run, written in response to decades of Black death at the hands of police. Let's get back to the conversation. There's a cultural shift going on right now as activists are asking cities to defund police departments, to consider how resources are allocated in law enforcement, in social services, and how that might be shifted. From where you sit, how are you processing everything that's happening right now?
Well, it's a long time coming. I am happy to see this moment. I'm happy to see that there is a paradigm shift that's happening. I will be optimistic about it. I believe that the marching and the protesting is easy to do when you're angry. It's easy to do when you've been cooped up on quarantine for the last 3 months and you want to get out of the house. And so your anger gives you a reason to get out of the house. And what I hope is that the energy and the push continues through the summer, when everybody would rather be on their jet skis and out at the beach or by the pool or whatever. I hope that the energy maintains. I hope that we can keep it going. And I would say that as far as the concept of defunding the police, I think there's some misunderstandings about exactly what that means. I live in Ferndale. And one thing I can say as a Ferndale resident is that, the police department here is actually pretty good for Ferndale residents. At the same time, they are guilty. I would call them guilty of over-policing 8 Mile Road.
On the edge of Ferndale and communities that are a little more racially diverse.
Yeah, so that, that spot on 8 Mile and Ferndale is just a place where there are a lot of traffic stops, and it just feels like there is, like, the Ferndale police are and I don't want to talk badly about the Ferndale police. I like the Ferndale police as a resident of Ferndale. Like I say, they're great. And this is where I think the idea of defunding the police is a little confusing to some people, because for most suburban police departments, those departments are not over policed. They do a good job of allocating resources and allocating funds. What tends to happen is in departments like Detroit, like Flint, like Benton Harbor, you might see policing in the African American community is handled quite differently. and the police are looked at as a almost an occupying force in a lot of areas. And so we really need to understand what this idea of defunding the police is about. It really is about, yes, it's about reallocating resources so that it makes more sense, and so the police are a community asset like they are to the residents of Ferndale, and not an aggressive and they're not the kind of deterrent. There's a different type of deterrent as they are for the people that are traveling down 8 Mile Road.
Right. In addition to being a multi-instrumentalist and a producer, you're also a dad. Do you mind sharing how you're talking to your young kids about what's going on right now, or if you are talking to them about it?
It's tough. They're seeing some things. We have 7-year-old twins. They're really smart. We're doing our best at this point to still shield them from a lot of these things. They did come behind me as I was watching a video a couple of weeks ago. And my son asked me, you know, why do the police shoot first and ask questions later? And I stumble with that one, right? The police here in Ferndale that they see are always very nice to them, and they love the police. They want to go and run up to them, and because the police give them stickers. That's what they think about the police, you know, at this point. And I don't want to discourage them from knowing that they can go to the police if something's wrong. But at the same time, as things are moving and or as they're getting older, they will and have been having more experiences that kind of show them. So I know a lot of parents have, you know, the talk with their kids, and we haven't had the talk yet because they're set. I mean, we haven't had to have that talk with them yet. There will probably be an instance in their lives where race becomes a bigger issue, and then we'll have to explain to them what's going on. They already notice it. They already talk about the fact that my son came to me and said that there are more beige kids than brown kids in their school.
Beige kids.
Beige kids, yes, yeah. Because if you looked at a crayon box, that's a more accurate description,
the,
right?
The Crayola nomenclature for race and ethnicity in 2020.
Exactly. So they speak in terms of beige and brown, and that's the way they understand it. And there are friends of theirs that would be considered African American that they consider look a little more beige than they do brown. And that's, oh yeah, it's true, but she's brown too. So it's that's the level where we're getting to our understanding, but they're noticing these differences. The differences haven't become problems as yet, as far as we can tell, but it's the time is coming soon as they get ready for second grade and as things are changing. I think, you know, with some of the incidents they're talking about that happened on the playground, we may have to have these discussions sooner rather than later. But I'm not looking forward to it at all.
Nadir Omawale has a new single called Run that is available this week. And if you buy on Friday, midnight to midnight Pacific time, Bandcamp will donate 100% of their share of sales to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Nadir, it's great talking to you. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks so much, April. I really appreciate it.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced today that she's optimistic about a return to in-person instruction at Michigan's K-12 schools this fall. She pointed to the state's declining COVID cases and actions putting us on the right track for kids being in public spaces. Here to tell us what we know about the governor's plan to reopen schools is Rick Pluta. He covers Lansing for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Okay. Governor Whitmer says that the Return to Learn Task Force is making some headway on what this will look like, the roadmap for schools to reopen. What do we know about the plan at this point?
Well, she said that the state is in a position so that the task force, I guess, has enough information that it can start making plans for schools to reopen, and that she's optimistic that the state will be in a place where that can actually occur. Beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about these plans other than they'll probably incorporate the safety restrictions that we've been operating under for a while now already, that in a lot of situations that people will have to wear masks, that there will be social distancing, that the task is going to be easier when we're dealing with the parts of the school year when more can be done outdoors than those parts of the school year when it's extremely cold and extremely hot, when everything has to take place indoors. Those are the sorts of things that we know. How these problems are going to be resolved, we don't know. And, you know, just to add to the complexity, right now, schools have to make these plans, which is going to require some level of expense, without knowing how much money to expect from the state, because their fiscal years begin on July 1st, and it's already become evident that the state's going to go past that date without having a budget in place and a school aid budget in place.
Right. We just saw that the legislature is making moves to work around the usual order that budgets have to be in place by July 1. Did you see Governor Whitmer seeming hesitant or skeptical in any way about schools reopening?
I wouldn't say hesitant or skeptical, but certainly cautionary. She said that we've got to keep an eye on things. And if we see spikes happening in some places, then schools in those regions might have to return to in-home learning, things like that. That where that happens, there are also complexities just in terms of resources, distance learning, what's available for that. And the complexities that would go along with having to learn from home, that none of these things are surefire, both in terms of plans to return to school and whether students will be able to remain in school, depending on what's happening with the levels of COVID cases in any region.
Rick, we have less than a minute left. Is there a possibility that this positive message about reopening could change ahead of the fall?
There is absolutely that possibility. And the governor and the public health director, Janae Khaldun, mentioned that multiple times, is that Michigan has had a lot of success in what's called flattening the curve. But we will very possibly see spikes in cases. That's one of the reasons why the anticipation is that this will be a regional approach. And so if you have to make a change in that it will at least be contained. And also, there are just complexities with resuming in-person schooling, but in a new way under these conditions. And so lots of things could change between now and the fall when school is hopefully going to start again.
Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Now, for some of us, open schools this fall might provoke a gigantic sigh of relief and a hope that things might feel more settled soon. But for others, it may come with a sinking feeling that so much remains to be worked out before that relief can happen. Paula Herbart is president of the Michigan Education Association. She's also part of Governor Whitmer's task force advising schools. Paula, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, April.
Rick Pluta just mentioned that the state will not be delivering its budget plans on time, and that includes K-12 budgets on July 1st. Can you tell us what financial state Michigan schools are in right now?
Well, we're currently looking at a possible deficit of $1.3 billion in the school aid fund coming this fall because of the economy not being able to be robustly open due to COVID-19. And we are working very hard to make sure that not only our state leaders look to reprioritize the dollars that are actually there and help fill the gaps in the state aid fund, but also for our federal legislators, Congress people, and senators to act and pass the HEROES Act that the House actually passed, and we're waiting on the Senate to take up, to supplant money, federal monies, into the state budget, all state budgets across the country, to ensure that schools are properly funded to do the kind of work that we know that they're going to have to do in the fall in the wake of COVID-19, as we are still in the midst of this first wave and possibly facing a second wave.
Sure. I feel like the governor's announcement can't have come as a complete shock to Michigan school districts. Glancing over plans, it seems like a lot of them at least had something on the drawing board for what in-person instruction might look like. But what do you think the schools will need as they get ready to start the shot clock toward in-person instruction?
Well, they're going to need to work with their local associations, whether it's educators or bus drivers, kitchen, custodial maintenance, to work out plans about how actually these school-wide plans will be implemented, because the stakes are high for all educators in public schools returning to school, not only health and safety concerns, but it's also important that there's buy-in, because we know that schools will be reliant on these educators all across their school system to implement whatever plan they put into place. And we need to make sure that students come prepared to understand exactly what the school district is going to be asking of them, and that employees and families know exactly what the school districts will be asking them.
Paula, we've spoken before about your members' concerns about showing up for in-person instruction. The survey that MEA put out a little bit earlier this month said that as many as a quarter to a third were at least kicking around this question about whether or not they should return, whether they would feel safe, whether they feel like they could handle the new paradigm. Have you since then had any new information about how many teachers do intend to come back to the classroom?
We don't have any new information, but one of the ways that we can mitigate them is helping them be a part of the planning process. Because if you're taking part in the development of those plans, there's a security and an understanding that your voice is being heard and that there will be room for you to have some control over your own professional destiny in this regard, and ensuring that your students are safe. So many of these educators are nervous about coming back to school when they're going to maybe have to be regulating mask wearing or social distancing in a way that really keeps them from doing the job of educating and being the social emotional support that these students are going to need when we return in the fall.
Sure. If you could get one point across to Michigan's budget writers about school needs right now, what do you think that would be?
If ever there was a time to reinvest and double down in the investment in public education, the time is now, because our students are more fragile than ever. They've had distance and remote learning for the past 3 months. They've had perhaps crises in their families, not only possibly having members contracting COVID, but maybe loss of jobs, loss of security of food and home. These students are going to be coming to the schools with more needs than ever. And so we need to support educators and students in more ways than ever. School nurses, social workers, counselors, making sure that we have small enough class sizes so that those schools can socially distance in a way that keeps us from having to do these higher level restraints like masking and face shields and all of that, because we know that these interpersonal relationships are so critical to student learning.
We've said it before, but it may bear repeating. A lot could change between now and the end of August. Do you think the governor made the right call?
I do. And I think that one of the things that the governor said is we need to be fluid and flexible, and we need to be listening to our health and public safety experts. As I said on your show before, just like we ask teachers to be the experts when we're talking about teaching students and student learning, we need to follow what the health experts say with regard to this pandemic to ensure that we're doing the right things for our students and our staff and the communities around us, to make sure that they're healthy and able to come to school in the best way possible.
Right. Paula Herbart is president of the Michigan Education Association. Paula, good to talk to you. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, April. I appreciate the time.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.